This is an ABC podcast. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, hello, welcome to The Country Hour for South Australia and Broken Hill. I'm Cassie Huff. Well, with a bit of rain around, graziers are rebuilding their flock and herd numbers across the state, and a key part of how successful that will be is the dog fence rebuild. Work in the north is ticking along, and northern graziers are watching the progress closely.
As far as dogs getting through the fence, certainly it has had a big impact on that. And we are finding that people are starting to put sheep in areas now where they haven't been able to put sheep for some time.
Some good news there. I'll have more on where the dog fence rebuild is up to. And has Australia reached peak grain acreage? There's a big crop in this year, but it's still hovering around the range that's been set for some time now. So are Australian farmers basically planting the maximum amount of grain area possible in this country? I'll get into that soon. But first, grain growers who believe their barley crops have been damaged by the pre-emergent herbicide Overwatch are being invited to join a class action against the manufacturer FMC. Sydney law firm Levitt Robinson alleges that FMC didn't give farmers enough guidance on applying Overwatch without causing crop damage. There have been some mixed reactions to the chemical this season. Some growers say it has been extremely effective in suppressing ryegrass and hasn't affected their crops, but others say it's caused bleaching and that will lead to yield penalties. Levitt Robinson special counsel Brett Imlay says the prospect of legal action was raised by a group of Western Victorian grain growers.
We've had contact with some significant growers in the Wimmera region, and that's where the initial concerns have been raised. And we're now getting registrations of interest from through Victoria and South Australia.
Those Wimmera growers who came to you, what did they say?
Well, they've had experience across their barley and wheat crops of bleaching, which is not growing out. They've used Overwatch either exclusively or in some of their paddocks, and they've got a very good comparator to see how their paddocks are going without the Overwatch and the paddocks where they've used the Overwatch, and they're forecasting loss of yields in the order of 30 to 40%.
And you're alleging essentially through this class action that that's FMC's fault?
Well, it's an investigation at the moment. Certainly, you know, there were some mild warnings about bleaching in crops, but the warnings were fairly soft in terms of the fact that the bleaching was expected to grow out and would not affect yield at all. There was a preference for a knife point sowing system, but certainly disc seeding was not prohibited by any of the literature.
If you do proceed, how will you attempt to allege FMC's liability?
Well, as I said, this is an investigation at the moment, but you know, we have a brand new pre-emergent herbicide, not only used for the first time in Australia, but used for the first time in the world. And all of the messages that FMC were putting out was that this product had been thoroughly tested and was safe for wheat and barley and canola. And yes, bleach, there would be some bleaching, but it would grow out. It would not affect yields. And that is not the experience. That is not what's happening. This was a premium product. It certainly, from what we hear, did a good job at controlling ryegrass. But, you know, at what price?
That was Brett Imlay, senior counsel with law firm Levitt Robinson. Christina Hermanson is managing director of FMC in Australia and New Zealand. She says reports of crop damage are limited.
We're really focused on what we need to be, which is investigating reports in the paddock on a case-by-case basis. And the reality is the incidence of really enhanced bleaching is still estimated at 1% of or less of the total crop area.
So you acknowledge around that 1% figure that we can assume we'll suffer yield losses. So then is FMC considering compensation for those growers?
Yes, we're following up. Our team is following up in the paddock. You know, at this point, it's September, so no one has actually suffered a measurable yield penalty until we get to harvest. But we're aware of some of the cases and where there's legitimate on-label use of FMC products and where there is a yield penalty at harvest. We'll address the grower concerned at that time, and we are following up in the paddock now.
So does that mean that if they have followed label directions and they still have damage, that you will offer financial compensation?
Yeah, we will follow up on a case-by-case basis, and you know, we're committed to do the right thing by our customers and our growers.
The label directions from FMC that accompanied Overwatch, I guess around sowing depth and seed chemical separation, those sorts of things, do you think those directions were strong enough, or should they have been stronger, and would that have avoided some of these situations of crop damage?
I think our label has been approved by the APVMA. We have stewardship modules that have been worked through with the reseller agronomists, and a lot of opportunity for agronomists to observe the program and the product in the paddock.
Christina Hermanson, Managing Director of FMC in Australia and New Zealand, ending that report by Angus Verley. Right to the north of the state now, where the dog fence rebuild is ticking away. About 280 kilometres has been completed since the project started 2 years ago. It's part of this $25 million project to rebuild 1,600 kilometres of the fence, which obviously protects the sheep industry from predation from dingoes and wild dogs. And the South Australian Dog Fence Board Chair, Jeff Power, says he's pleased with the rate of the rebuild.
Well, as at the end of August, 280 kilometres have been completed, and the rebuild underway is roughly 460 kilometres, with also some other areas there having earthworks.
This is a 1,600 kilometre project, though. So how do you feel about the progress that has been made?
Well, I think we're on track. You know, say at the end of the year, we've roughly completed 600 kilometres and we've set up another few hundred kilometres to be done next year. I think we're well on the way of completing the project in time. And certainly at this stage, you know, we're very happy with the progress we've made.
Is this where you wanted to be when this project started?
Look, I think it is. You know, initially, there's a lot of work that has to be done to set sections up. You've got to earthworks, and you've got to, you know, tenders and things like that. And you've got wet weather events that probably held us up a bit, plus COVID. But to be where we are at this stage, I think that we're very happy.
From what you've seen so far, has there been any indication as to whether the dog fence that has been, the parts that have been built so far, have actually reduced predation or helped pastoralists and farmers in any way?
I believe as far as dogs getting through the fence, certainly it has had a big impact on that. And we are finding that people are starting to put sheep in areas now where they haven't been able to put sheep for some time. So, look, there's still dogs out there, but we've certainly made a big difference with both our baiting and trapping programs inside the fence.
Drought has also reduced their numbers a lot, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes. No, look, yeah, I must say that, yeah, the drought has had an impact as well.
Based on how it's going so far, when is the dog fence slated to be completed?
It's a five-year project, and at the end of 2021, we'll be 2 years into that five-year project. So if you do the sums of what has been completed and what's being rebuilt at the moment, we are on track.
South Australian Dog Fence Board Chair Jeff Power speaking with Lucas Forbes. Pastoralist Gordon Litchfield lives at Wilperina Station, which borders the dog fence near Maree. He says he's happy to see the works going ahead because the fence is vital to the sheep industry.
Well, our livelihood depends on it, you know, running sheep on the inside of the dog fence, and we bear the brunt of the dogs, and there's a lot of properties, you know, either side of us that don't run sheep anymore inside the dog fence. The dogs come in, not so, you know, more dingoes on the inside of the fence are a big problem. You know, we've got to clean up as well as, I hope they get it'll be a bit of a help when they get the old fence replaced. But the old fence did a good job.
How big of an issue have they been for you in the past?
Oh, well, you know, I suppose it slowly gets better, and it's been, you know, the dingoes have not been as thick, so the less number of dingoes around, the less problem it is, but we were getting a lot of dingoes, you know, inside the fence, right up until about 6 months ago. I suppose it's backed off a bit, but one time the stations, you know, a lot of properties, they had a full-time bloke, that's his job, is just trapping dogs and shooting dogs and poisoning dogs or whatever. But now with, you know, there's not so much manpower, there's not, you know, we still get a lot of things done, but with a lot less people, and you know, you'd have a full-time person doing that one time, but now the person's got about 10, does about 10 jobs at one, that, you know, 10 people used to do, now one person's got to do.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we work any harder, but we've got to get a lot more done.
Māori pastoralist Gordon Litchfield speaking with Lucas Forbes there, and isn't that the truth, that a lot less people out there doing the jobs that there were once a lot more people to do. It means there's a lot less people in the regions, which is unfortunate because there's such a lively community out there. Now, before I get to the weather and markets, farmers' ideas on how to tackle the growing issue of dryland salinity are being put to the test at new demonstration sites across the state. Marylands, Mallee and Eyre Peninsula farmers have shared their experiences and their approaches to tackling salinity on their properties. And now, Marylands and Riverland Landscape Board are going to check these treatments out, as Regional Agriculture Land Care Facilitator Zoe Starkey explains.
It's been exacerbated by drought. So whilst it might have, has probably been there for quite a while, the recent number of dry years that we've had across the northern Mallee and Murray Plains have really brought this issue to a head. We're seeing some farmers with up to 100 hectares affected across their farm, and that's producing zero crop no matter what input. And it seems to be growing, unfortunately. So it's something that we really need to get a handle on and understand a bit better.
And what were some of the costs like? Did that surprise you?
Yeah, definitely. Some farmers estimate up into the six figures over a long period of time. Some not so much. It does vary with input costs, but yeah, it is definitely very concerning for the farmers' bottom lines, but also for their soil health. You don't want to go into summer with bare ground and have dust all year round. So it is something that they're very concerned about, not only financially, but for their soil health as well.
And this was also taken over the Eyre Peninsula, which has had a bit more rain than we have here.
So over there, they've got a slightly different soil type, but very similar in, you know, long-term average rainfall. Not so much this year. They're having a blinder over there this year, but it's definitely still an issue. And that, yeah, they're moving into that, you know, how do we manage it and keep that land productive? Whilst they've had a good year over there, they're still seeing areas that can't establish the crop on. So the rain hasn't actually flushed the salt back down through the profile to enable crop establishment. Moving into this management phase of the project is definitely going to be crucial with moving forward and hopefully not only just putting a band-aid on the issue, but fixing it long-term.
And in the survey, what did farmers say they had been doing to manage the issue?
Things as simple as spreading a bit of sand over the top, varying depth. Organic matter has also been shown to help with crop establishment, the use of chaff and hay, and also stuff like straw and pig manure from piggeries has been used. Whilst we've seen some good results, we're unsure of exactly how long these treatment methods will work on the land and whether, you know, the next dry spell comes and we see the salt rise back up through it. So that's something that we're monitoring very closely, and we'll hopefully have some more data on it in the next year or so.
And you mentioned that the next step will be really to look at treatment and management. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so we want to set up some demo sites. Whilst farmers have done some on-farm, obviously management themselves, we want to really set up some demos that we can really control what we're doing, monitor multiple times throughout the year, and by first establishing a baseline and then applying the management treatment, whether that be sand, organic matter, even maybe into the soil amelioration by using rippers, inclusion plates and refinators, and then monitor how the salt then moves after that management has been applied, and then try and predict how long potentially that management will last. We'll even like move into flushing the system, so the application of water, stimulate a rainfall event, and see how the salt then reacts under that management going forward.
Considering that some of these losses are in the six figures, is there more support and potentially funding needed to help farmers to manage this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's something that we're always keeping an eye out for and exploring. We are in very much in an investigative mode. This has been a project that's been building over the last 18 months. to, yeah, hopefully engage some higher level funding from somewhere, and, you know, definitely help farmers, give them a clear option of, you know, how to fix this issue and bring that land back into production for them.
Regional Agriculture Landcare Facilitator Zoe Starkey speaking with Eliza Bellage. Now we'll head across to the markets now, because John Traeger has the results from the Dublin sheep and cattle sale.
Good afternoon. Numbers increased substantially as agents offered 10,000 lambs and 2,000 sheep. Two additional Victorian buyers returned this week and provided extra competition to the usual buying group. New season's young lamb quality and weights increased as prices again lifted by an average $20 per head under this added competition and a better quality offering. Older lamb quality was also improved and the limited supply saw strong competition. The few extreme light young and older lambs on offer lacked support and eased by up to $20 and more in places. Mutton quality was again good, with prices generally firm to previous sale for type and condition. Extremely light young lambs sold from 74 to 100 as light weights range from 93 to 170. Light trade weights sold from 143 to a top of 216 as medium weights range from 196 to $260. Heavy weights sold from 245 to a top of $310 per head. Extremely light older lambs sold from 119 to 172 as light weights range from 160 to 176. Light trade weights sold from 169 to 198 as medium weights range from 180 to $244. Heavy weights sold from 240 to 266, with extreme heavyweights selling from $272 to a top of $350 per head. Light hoggets sold from 110 to 166 as heavyweights range from 150 to $220 per head. Medium weight ewe mutton sold from 122 to 170. Medium weights range from 160 to 242 as heavyweights sold from 184 to $222 per head. Young merino ewes sold from 136 to 190, with rams selling from 158 to $167 per head. Meanwhile, in the cattle market, quality was again extremely mixed as agents offered 150 live weight cattle and 50 open oxen calves. Competition was fair to good from restockers, with few suitable trade cattle on offer. Prices remained firm to marginally dearer across the offering. Steer veal is sold to 586 cents as veal heifers sold to 550. Light yielding steers sold to 618 cents as medium weights range from 562 to 598. Heavy weights sold from 470 to 572 cents. Light yielding heifers sold from 520 to 586 cents. Medium weights range from 538 to 566, as the few heavyweights sold from 470 to 548 cents a kilo. Grain steers sold from 400 to 500 cents, with grain heifers selling from 370 to 460, with a top of 544 cents for B-muscled score 3 heavyweight heifer. Light cows sold from 180 to 250 cents, medium weights sold to 230, as heavyweights sold from 320 to 326 cents a kilo. This has been John Traeger at the South Australian Livestock Exchange for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the Country Hour.
Thanks for that, John. And Peter Kerr in Mount Gambier has the results from the cattle sale.
Good afternoon, Cassie. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 8th of September. Numbers remain steady as agents showed 516 head of live weight and open auction cattle. These sold to the usual array of trade and processor buyers along with feeder and restocker interest. Quality was very mixed, with some pens needing some more weight and conditioning to be fully finished. However, this didn't deter the buying group, as the main market mainly sold at dearer rates. Yearling steers all went on to feed as they returned from 507 to 555, similar heifers from 424 to 530 cents a kilogram. The trade sought heifers from 380 to 532 cents. Brown steers and bullocks made from 422 to 518 cents to the trade, with feeder activity from 430 to 522. Brown heifers made from 445 to 478 cents, with feeder support from 453 to 505, as manufacturing steers range from 340 to 415 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows remained fully firm in price to return from 394 to 444, with the lighter types making from 300 to 400 cents, with restocker interest from 340 to 390, as bulls mainly range from 276 to 350 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Peter. Now we'll head across to the Bureau of Meteorology now, where I'm joined by Senior Forecaster Tom Bogue. Good afternoon.
Yes, so hello, Cassie.
So it was pretty clear across the state through the morning after a rather cool start. So what's on the forecast?
Yeah, well, certainly those dry conditions will be continuing today, and your temperatures are going to be warming up over the next few days. We have a high pressure system which has pretty well been centred over South Australia for the last 24 hours or so. It's going to be moving slowly eastwards, should be over New South Wales sort of later this evening, and then moving out to the Tasman Sea for the later part of the week there. So we're still going to be remaining under the influence of that system for a couple of days. So that will see northerly winds persisting for certainly for Thursday, Friday, with the increasing temperatures associated with that as well. So for Thursday, should be sort of generally warm, grading to even hot in the far west, those northeast and northwesterly winds, mostly sunny as well. Maybe a little bit of cloud around the southern coastal districts, but it should be sunny over the remainder. For Friday, possibly some morning fog for Kangaroo Island and the southeast districts, but then it'll be dry and mostly sunny during the day. And temperatures with that warming trend, so warm grading to hot in the north and west, with northeast to northwesterly winds, probably starting to freshen a bit in the south and west. And for Saturday, gradual change in the weather. I think the daytime hours will be still dry, but we do have a change coming up for later. So as we move into the evening period, there will be a slight to medium chance of some showers developing late afternoon, or probably more likely in the evening for the southern agricultural area and also near the western coasts, probably increasing to a high chance of showers for the southern coastal districts as we move into the evening. Now, winds will start off as being north-northwesterly and freshen during the day, but there'll be a west-to-southwesterly change developing over the west and south, and that change will then be extending northwards during the evening period. For Sunday then, there's some cold air coming in behind the change there, so colder conditions coming in with a high chance of showers for the southern agricultural area, even a very high chance for the southern coasts, the lower southeast, and just a slight to medium chance of some showers for the northern agricultural area. Also possible thunderstorm activity and some small hail near the southern coasts and the southeast districts, and the winds will be moderate to fresh southwest to southerly, so sort of colder conditions coming in with that. Now, as we move into the sort of period of next week then, cool to cold in the south, grading to mild in the far north, then it'll be becoming milder throughout on Wednesday, and also tending towards warm to hot in the far west of the state. Now, the mornings look like being cold. There'll be some frost areas, but cloud will be increasing towards the middle of the week, and there's a slight chance of some showers extending from the west there. Now, as far as the rainfall totals go for the next few days, so dry conditions expected throughout until later on Saturday, when we do start to see the impact of that system change coming from the west. Thereafter, from sort of midnight, thereafter until midnight on Sunday, so late Saturday and up to the end of Sunday, the cumulative rainfall totals expected to be less than 2 millimetres for the northern agricultural area and near the western coasts, increasing up to 2 to 5 millimetres for the southern agricultural area, and reaching 5 to 10 millimetres about the southern coasts and also the lower southeast district, and over the Mount Lofty ranges to the south of about the Barossa Valley. So, just to clarify that, dry until later on Saturday, and then some of that shower activity giving those rainfall totals from later Saturday and on Sunday there, Cassie. So it's back to you.
Thanks for that, Tom. It's only quite a small, about 50% chance, though. So is there sort of a bit of ambiguity still about where that rain's going to fall on Saturday and Sunday?
Well, there's probably not going to be a great deal later on Saturday, but for Sunday, with that colder change coming through, I think the southern agricultural area is certainly in with a very high chance of showers and probably sort of a medium chance or even medium to high chance for the northern agricultural area. The totals are not huge, though, at this stage.
Thanks so much for that. That was Tom Bowick from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there in the far west of New South Wales. It's going to be sunny in the upper western. There will be some patches of morning frost, though, in the southeast. Overnight temperatures will fall to about 3 degrees, up to maybe a minimum of 8, and the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s. The lower western will be sunny. There could be some patches of frost in the far east there as well in the early morning, and overnight temperatures will fall to between 3 to 9 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff.
Hi, it's great to have your company this afternoon. Now, one of the big growth areas for agriculture has been plant-based proteins. But as with animal protein, consumers are increasingly wanting to know how it's produced and how sustainable it is.
So carbon neutral is the headline that everyone's chasing because it can be measured. But I think we've got the opportunity to, well, what's the story behind the headline? Is it going to be regenerative agriculture? Is it going to be offsets using the land that the crops are grown on? There's many different ways.
And it's becoming increasingly important in this plant-based protein space. Also, if you love avocados, you're going to be spoilt for choice for a while. But with all the extra fruit coming onto the market, how will the industry ensure customers are getting the best possible fruit? I'll have more on that soon. I know what it's like to cut open an avocado and have lots of brown bits in there. They're trying to stop that, make sure consumers have a great eating experience. I'll explain more on that soon. But first, we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glamacek. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Cassie. In the news this hour, New South Wales has recorded 1,480 new cases of COVID-19 and 9 more deaths. An unvaccinated man in his 20s who had serious underlying health conditions is among the fatalities. It takes the total since the start of the Delta outbreak to 148. Victoria's Premier Daniel Andrews has announced that lockdown will end for all of regional Victoria except for Shepparton from midnight tomorrow. Victoria's been in lockdown down for more than a month and today recorded 221 new cases of COVID-19. In our state, it's claimed that a Port Augusta family was forced to take their sick baby in a taxi to hospital recently as there were no ambulances available locally. The Ambulance Employees Association says the incident at the end of August is not isolated. Despite 12 new recruits set to join the Spencer Gulf in March, the union's Josh Karpowitz says he fears the system wouldn't be able to cope in the event of a COVID-19 outbreak. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, demand for plant-based protein is booming, but countries like the EU and multinational corporations around the world are demanding suppliers of plant-based food be sustainable as well. Now, the importance of sustainability, there's been a lot of focus on that in the animal protein sector, but if you eat plant protein products, do you look at how sustainable they are? I'd love to know. 0467922891 is the number to text or phone 1300 222891. What are the main things that you're looking for if you are eating plant-based proteins? It could be a bit of a threat to Australian growers if they're not certified or carbon neutral, but there's also a huge opportunity in this space, as David Claughton reports.
Australia's biggest grain co-op, CBH, and a leading plant-based food company discussed the issues around plant-based meat at a virtual grains forum this week. Nick Hazel, the founder and CEO of V2 Food, says the demand for protein globally is going to double, whether it's meat or plant-based, and there's not enough land to produce it. So he thinks there's a huge opportunity for Australian growers.
Globally, we cannot support the growth of meat consumption with animal meat. It is physically impossible. There is really not enough land on this planet to support doubling the amount of meat we produce. As people get wealthier, they eat more meat, and that's what's happening. And as the demographics sort of shift, we will be eating twice the amount of meat. And so if you then do the maths on where is this going to come from, well, actually, Australia has an enormous opportunity to be the supplier of this plant-based meat for the world, when we already export a huge amount of animal-based meat to the world. And from V2 Foods perspective, we want to be Australian so that we can export plant-based meat to these enormous market opportunities, particularly in Asia and in the developing countries around the world.
Cooperative Bulk Handling has been supplying markets in the EU with certified grain for a decade now. All of their canola growers are signed up to the International Sustainability and Carbon Certification Scheme. And Jane Wardle, the Sustainability Manager from CBH, says they've been earning premiums to supply that market.
WA growers would have gotten around $400 million in premium on that certification over the last 10 years. So look, for them, it's just we're trying to build the market for ISCC plus grain. It could turn into a market access issue rather than a direct premium. So we've certainly had some interest from some of the bigger manufacturers who have their own sustainable sourcing programs. So to be able to supply to those companies would certainly be a big bonus for WA growers.
So if Australia was to go big on producing more crops for plant-based meat industries, where would they be grown? Nick Hazel says he's looking at northern New South Wales and southern Queensland.
And our view is that we should be contracting with farmers, particularly up sort of northern rivers and the Queensland areas where good rotation for cane. And our calculations are that, you know, the sort of the 150,000 tons, which is the amount that we'd need to be the feedstock for extraction plant in Australia, absolutely doable, and actually many, many times that, if the incentives are right. I mean, obviously farmers need to make money from this, and I think that is an opportunity for us to kind of maybe break the system a little bit, contract long term with farmers, pay a premium, work with farmers to have the right quality, because the quality here is everything.
Nick Hazel wants to break the bulk commodity-based growing system and contract directly with growers to plant the varieties they need.
I don't think it's in our interest to work with farmers to grow commodities. We actually want differentiation, and sustainability is part of that, quality is part of that. And my experience in the food industry is all the best food industry products that I've been involved with, you know, like Smith's Chips, for example, they're vertically integrated with the farmer, and the quality actually starts with the farmer and the farm and the varieties that you grow. And I think that this industry is exactly the same.
He's also convinced that the sector needs to figure out how to store a lot more carbon in the soil.
We need to be carbon neutral. Nothing else is going to cut it in the future. And so for us, you know, our carbon footprint is about 2.5 kilos of carbon per kilo of meat that we make, the V2. We've got a plan to get it to zero. And an important part of that plan is we're going to have to sequester carbon in the agricultural part of the business. So that's growing the soy and growing the canola in such a way that we're capturing 2 tons of carbon per hectare or more in the soils. And that's for us to get to carbon zero, because the consumer isn't looking for companies, certainly agricultural companies, to be getting someone else to solve the carbon problem. That's our problem to solve. And we won't solve it without working with the farmers to find a solution in European countries. This is real. This is, people are really moving fast. And the potential is huge. We grow, there's a lot of cropping in Australia, so the potential is enormous.
And I think, Nick, that's the important part. So carbon neutral is the headline that everyone's chasing because it can be measured. But I think we've got the opportunity to, well, what's the story behind the headline? Is it going to be regenerative agriculture? Is it going to be offsets using the land that the crops are grown on? There's many different ways, and we just need to find the story behind the headline that's going to work best for the growers, but also it's going to be most readily accepted by the consumers as well.
Jane Wardle, Sustainability Manager from CBH. You also heard from Nick Hazel, the founder and CEO of V2 Food. So how important is the sustainability of plant-based proteins to you? And what are some of the main considerations you think about when you're buying the product? Text me on 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. And speaking of plant-based proteins, obviously grain production is key to plant-based protein, and South Australia is on track to produce a very large crop this year. September is in particular a very important month for delivering on that promise, and farmers are looking for rain, but if that arrives, the crop yield will be among the largest ever. But has Australia as a whole hit peak grain acreage? And by that, I mean, has the maximum amount of land that could go towards grain production been reached? ANZ's head of food, beverage and agribusiness, Michael Whitehead, has been looking at this topic. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kathy.
On this question, has Australia reached peak grain acreage? Can you perhaps explain the development of cropping in Australia and how we got to this point?
Absolutely, and it's fascinating to look at. If you look back over cropping and combine it with looking at sheep and cattle numbers, the three main parts of the agricultural pie in Australia, go back over decades, let's say 60 years, cropping has been on the up and up. 60 years ago, we were growing about 8 million hectares, and it's continued to climb and continued to climb until about the last 10 years. Now, absolutely, there's been volatility that comes with drought, but it really looks like it's plateauing out around that 20 to 23 million hectare mark. The important thing to look at, and you mentioned in your lead up that have we hit the peak amount of land that could be used for grain, is that grain and sheep often move in tandem. When there is more grain acreage, there's less sheep. If sheep enthusiasm goes up, prices for sheep, people want to put more sheep on their places, then grain acreage goes down. So you could look at it in two ways. One, that we may have plateaued in the amount of country that we want to put into grain, and two, that we could almost have reached an equilibrium in a way between sheep cropping and cattle numbers in a way in Australia.
So it's largely sheep that are the main competition for land use. But what about other factors like climate change or urban encroachment? How much of an effect is that having?
They are two very interesting points. Urban encroachment is one that certainly impacts crops in a number of other parts of the world. The US and China are two big examples where they grow a lot of crops, but they've got a lot more cities. So as those areas grow out, they eat into cropland. Not so much an issue in Australia with the smaller population and where the outer suburbs aren't really taking up too many paddocks. Climate, on the other hand, is an interesting one, and it will be the subject of debate, and debate is a terrific thing. But if you look at the fact that climate may change how much yields can come out of certain amounts of ground, or how much ground may have volatile rainfall and volatile temperatures as well, it really increases the necessity of the industry to keep working on R&D, on drought-proofing seeds, on the right utilisation of water, on the right way of utilising and treating soils as well, to make sure that both the productivity and the sustainability of our cropping operations goes up and stays as it should be.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that grain production in Australia has plateaued, just the area that it could have been grown on may have plateaued, depending on people's enthusiasm for sheep versus grain production in this country. Just how much more do you think can be derived from the same amount of land using R&D and breeding more varieties that perhaps have higher yields?
Well, this is part of not the $64 million question, but the $100 billion question. For many in Australian agriculture, there is this aspirational target of producing $100 billion worth of production by 2030. We currently sit in the 60s, in the billions as well. To make grain production keep going up, where can it stop? And it's on an upward trend at the moment. Eventually, it has to stop at some point. There is only so much you can extract out of the soil and out of a crop, and with the water that we have and with the climate that we have. But every year, there are some great developments happening in whether it's the way the soil's managed, whether it's drought-proofing some of the seeds or looking at the technology there, whether it's in the ag tech as well, whether it's in that crossover. So that will continue to change. If there is land that at some point won't be applicable for grain as well, a lot of that land will still work for sheep. And sheep are a different but very important discussion too, because as the demand globally for sheep meat goes up very sharply, and we're seeing that happen, that will be a very viable operation for so many farmers or mixed farmers as well.
So do you think Australia has reached peak grain acreage?
In terms of peak grain acreage, in that plateau, there is a very reasonable chance that we have. It doesn't mean that that is the plateau where we are growing things. We are seeing a large amount of new crops like nuts going in, a lot of new horticultural operations going in, both for the domestic demand and for the export demand as well. There are a lot of developments happening in water which may change some of those areas and what's being put in those areas. And people continue to explore operations in northern Australia, whether it's for horticulture, whether it's for cotton or others. But in terms of the grain acreage, whether it's in South Australia, a lot of that great cropping country, the great cropping country in WA and through the rest of the country as well, it could well be that at about 25 million hectares, that is where we will, that's the top we will see for the time being.
Some interesting insights there. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Kathy.
ANZ's Head of Food, Beverage and Agribusiness, Michael Whitehead, with some insights into whether or not Australia has reached the maximum amount of area that could grow grain or crops in this country. I had a text in from Roger saying it would be good if peak grain area plateau meant cessation of tree and forest destruction. Also had a couple of texts on plant-based proteins. Patricia has texted in to say, I would rather eat protein from insects than ever buy plant-based proteins. And another texter says, sustainability must include facing up to human overpopulation. Thanks so much for those texts. You can keep letting me know your thoughts on these topics. Text me 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. It's 1:45.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
Gillian is from the Buttered Scone Cafe. Can I ask what the tips are for the recipe in your cafe?
No, you can't.
Oh, it's a secret. Squirrels, is it?
You will find that you will start wars all over rural Australia because everybody has a different recipe. And as soon as they hear what you do with your scone, they're going to say, no way.
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
And I will be exchanging some scone tips, so keep listening to the program. But in the meantime, I don't know if I'd put avocado on a scone, but once upon a time it would take maybe about a fortnight for an avocado to be picked, packed, purchased and smashed up on a piece of toast near you, perhaps even a scone. But with the unprecedented volumes of fruit starting to flow and that trend only expected to increase in years to come, the prospect of avocados spending more time in cold storage is a reality that will challenge just about every part of the supply chain in the future. Queensland Department of Agriculture Principal Horticulturist Noel Ainsworth says that's why decisions are being made in orchards right now that will be critical to guaranteeing a good eating experience next season.
I guess it's that hidden variability that we're looking into now, because we traditionally have seen fruit going from the paddock to a consumer in only, say, 14 days. It's all fairly fast. And that includes a period of a few days of ripening and includes periods at retail. So, you know, it's been fairly fast. But when we see that changing from, say, 14 days up to 30 days, we start to see some differences appearing. And it bears out the sort of processes that some people have put in place right from the start and others have maybe cut some corners on. And that includes, you know, really good disease management practices in the orchard, and that can be as simple as good canopy management or hygiene, but it's also about spray programs that are well timed around weather and those sort of things. So we're starting to see those things bearing fruit. I'm not sure if that's the correct word, but
it might be a terrible pun.
But it's about, you know, appropriate management of the risk. Because certainly what we know about avocado consumers is that a smaller proportion of the population probably consume most of them, and they consume them regularly. If they get a bad experience, they'll normally stop buying for a couple of weeks, and that's what we're trying to avoid. We're really trying to make sure we get a consistent product for people who enjoy avocados.
If the message is quality, not quantity, for season 2022 and beyond, what kind of decision-making, how does that change or influence the way farmers are making decisions right now about their orchards?
I think it's getting all the things right. It's I know there's been a lot of attention in the last couple of years to making sure we've improved our supply chains, and normally that's something that a lot of growers haven't been really aware of. But with a lot of new technology now, we can remotely access information about what's happening in trucks and through the supply chains and where it's happening. So that's a lot more accessible, that information now, to growers. And people haven't just been sitting on that. They've been acting on that, and we've seen some real improvements. So that's been a good result. But there's always going to be that variability in terms of every farm and every block. And making sure you're aware of that and acting appropriately, making sure that, you know, that the best fruit can go to that supply chain, which is going to have to put up with the greatest journey, whether it be export or storage. So making sure your wholesaler and ripener knows which is the batch of fruit that has to really be sold quickly and which isn't.
You must be pleased at the demonstration at these types of forums in the thirst for knowledge that growers have. In the time that you have been involved with the avocado industry, what kind of changes, what kind of quantum changes have you seen? You walk through an orchard now that might not have been there 20 years ago.
Yeah, look, certainly there's been a lot of changes. I mean, avocados have always been a difficult crop to grow. They've got a fairly rudimentary and basic root system, which isn't really well adapted to Australia in the first place. And people have been much more conscious of that. And it happens on those odd events where there's a cyclone or heavy deluge, and avocado trees won't put up with that. So we've seen a lot more people look very much at shaping orchards, pre-planting, you know, much more attention to the use of mulch. They're all elements which help look after the real basics of the tree, you know, that root system, and help it deliver that crop that they need it to do.
If change is the one constant, Noel Ainsworth, how well equipped do you believe the industry is to withstand the shockwaves that are to come in terms of meeting this great challenge of an oversupply and making sure that those growers that look after their orchards in the way that you're recommending are rewarded for that effort?
The supply in Australia is a real fluid thing. Up till now, most of the Australian production has met most of the Australian need. But certainly for a number of years now, we've had a significant portion of fruit in our domestic market from New Zealand, particularly over our December-January period, which sort of fills that gap between the end of our season for the West Australian producers and the start of the shepherd season for the North Queensland producers. But going forward, whether the fruit that comes out of Atherton here is destined for Sydney or Singapore, and if the stuff in Sydney is in competition with stuff from New Zealand or Chile or Peru in the future or Mexico, who've also got applications there, it does come down to quality and being able to meet that consumer's expectation for not only the appearance but also the taste of that fruit. And that, you know, the appearance is that first purchase and the taste for the second purchase.
Queensland Department of Agriculture Principal Supply Chain Horticulturalist Noel Ainsworth speaking with Charlie McKillop. Now, finally today, no, the Royal Adelaide Show was cancelled this year, but groups of school kids are still heading to Wavell Showgrounds this week for this year's School Merino Weathers Competition. It's on today, and thankfully it was still able to go ahead, and the South East School of Lucendale Area School is taking part. Megan Hughes was able to chat with Senior Agricultural Teacher Carol Hilly while they were stopped for a quick break at Tintinara on their way to Adelaide.
So it's been a bit of a long journey. Back in February, we started the journey in selecting weathers from a breeder, and the kids have been busy preparing them up until now for this weather competition.
And how are the sheep looking?
They're looking fantastic. They're just over 100 kilos. We're really impressed with how they're looking. They're in great condition. So fingers crossed we do well down at the competition.
And what exactly do you get judged on in this comp?
There's lots of different aspects they judge. They look at things like weight gain and also the most valuable fleece, as well as the structure and the meat value of the animal. So, yeah, it all combines together.
And why is a competition like this so important for kids?
It just gives the kids a really good grounding and understanding of the meat industry and the wool industry, and just really goes into those aspects in detail. It also gives the students a great opportunity to compete against other schools and just see such a large number of different qualities of sheep all in the one area. So it's quite a unique opportunity for the kids to develop this learning in this sort of environment.
And you must be so happy that you were able to do this. Obviously, the Royal Adelaide Show has been cancelled for this year, but this event was able to go ahead.
Absolutely. No, we're incredibly pleased that we can go ahead with it. Six students out of my class of 27 have been able to have this opportunity, so we're definitely feeling very fortunate to be able to come down and compete and give these students that opportunity.
Lucendale Area School Senior Agricultural Teacher Carolyn Hilly. One of the kids on the trip with her is Year 9 student Bradley Smith. He explains what the experience has been like.
Well, yeah, it's a good experience. At the start of the year, I partaked in the SE or the Sheep Expo, which that was a great learning curve for me and sort of brought me back into the sheep industry.
What's your background? Have you grown up on a sheep property? Are your family in agriculture, or is this something completely new to you?
Nah, I've always grown up in the sheep industry. My dad works on one of McBride's companies down in the southeast, and we have our own property up near Mundala there. So I've always grown up around sheep and always enjoyed it.
Picking the sheep that you're going to show, what sort of characteristics were you looking for?
I always look for the structure of a sheep, like how sound their whole body is, their teeth, all the important stuff about a sheep, what their back's like and what their fat structure's like.
And are you happy with how the animals that you're putting in are looking?
Yeah, I'm extremely happy. These are some very nice-looking animals we've produced here at the show.
And how would you describe the experience of raising these sheep to show?
It's a very good experience because you get a bond with the sheep, so you really know what their temperament's like when you're showing them and how you want to control them when you're haltering them.
When you actually go down there tomorrow, what are you required to do?
We will take them around a ring, and then the overjudge will tell us to bring them all and line them up, and then she'll look at our skills, how we handle the sheep and how we present the sheep to the overjudge.
Throughout this experience, what are your main takeaways? What exactly do you think you've learnt from this experience?
Different aspects of how other people can judge sheep, like older people from in the industry, like their different ways of handling a sheep compared to my ways of how I handle a sheep.
Yeah. And is there anything in particular that you think you'll do differently going forward?
I'll try and keep more eye contact with the judge this time going around, because at the Sheep Expo I didn't really concentrate on the judge as much as people would.
Lucindale Area School student Bradley Smith speaking with Megan Hughes. And fortunately, those students were able to compete in the competition, the School Merino Weathers Competition. It's normally held at the Royal Adelaide Show, but obviously the Royal Adelaide Show didn't go ahead this year. But we've been missing it so much here at the ABC that we decided to mark the show with our own little competition, a Show Us Your Scone competition. Last year it was baking, this year it's scone making. And the rivalry is getting quite fierce. Sonia Feldhoff.
Hello. Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about
you, Cassie. You're competitive.
Well... I'm a little bit concerned because now that Cassie's joining us.
Yeah, I didn't do it last year.
In the competition. You might not know, but Cassie's got country background. And I just think that might make her the dark horse in all
of
this.
I think it's a psychological warfare.
Because, like, if you think scones, you think country, don't you?
Yeah.
Country cafes and bakeries and all that. And you did, right?
Yeah. We used to have tennis a lot at home. Different farms would have tennis and Mum would always make scones for our visitors. So I am au fait with a very quick batch of scones being made up.
Okay. So is that your go-to when you know someone's just coming around? Like,
That's the saying. I think where we are from, the saying is you should, by the time someone is at your side gate, you should be able to have a scone mix made and in the oven by the time they get to your front door. Obviously, gardens are bigger in the country.
Well, I'd have to go to the shops first.
But that was the benchmark. That's what Mum used to say.
So this is my concern. I know we're going to be using your recipes, and this is a really important thing. You've got to get your recipes in by midnight tonight. If you think you've got the special scone recipe or a different variation on it, we want to hear from it. Send in your special and traditional scone recipes. Go to the ABC website, abc.net.au/Adelaide. Click on the tile recipe there.
And they can be sweet or savoury.
They can be sweet or savoury. They can be lemonade and cream or whatever that sort of secret recipe is there. I remember my old recipe is with the rubbing method.
Yeah.
So, but they can be a bit denser, I think.
See, I think lemonade, they're great scones, but you've got to eat them quickly. And they have to be cooked the night before and judged the next day. So I'd be worried if I got a lemonade scone.
Is that
recipe.
Right?
That's my experience with lemonade scones.
So if one of the recipes involves lemonade, you reckon do it on the day?
You
have to do it on the day and eat it within
a short
period.
They're much better fresh, I think.
Okay. So do you, how do you rate yourself? Because I reckon you're the dark horse.
No, I have a terrible oven. Yeah, it's not my recipe, so I do have a little trick, but it's not my recipe and I have a terrible oven. So that won't help either.
Did you say you've got a special trick?
Yeah, I've got a little trick.
Are you prepared to reveal this?
Am I prepared to reveal it? Well, it's my grandmother's.
Yeah.
She reckons that if you're using cream, you want cream that's just about to turn
off.
Yeah, not quite, so not almost off, sour but, cream. Getting there. Yeah, that's the trick, supposedly, according to my great-grandmother. Great-grandmother, not grandmother. So,
okay.
But we'll love to hear from
Scones
you.
Scones Friday afternoon.
Keep listening to ABC Local Radio. Sonia has a lot more coming up this afternoon, though. That's all from me, though. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.